The next 50 years of statehood are sure to usher in a new era for the Arctic part of Alaska. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. What are the potentials for Arctic development and how are they being seen in other countries? Is the U.S. losing opportunities because of its pattern of ignoring Alaska? The phone lines open 1-800-478-8255 and Anchorage a local call at 550-8422, email talk at APRN.org. The future history of the Arctic is the subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Well, we've heard it so many times that we're really completely numb to it, but it's a reality. The climate is warming. The polar areas are differentially affected by the warming climate. The Arctic sea ice is thinning and going away more than it has in the past. And what this does is opens up the Arctic Ocean. The question is, what now? Does the Arctic at some point become the Mediterranean? Does the Arctic Ocean become the center of civilization with a warming climate? And how many years from now does what happen? And so forth. And everybody's looking at this. Anybody in the policy area is whatever you want, whether it's science, whether it's mineral exploration, whether it's international law. The implications of an opening Arctic are staggering and different from the kinds of dreams that the polar explorers once had, but not all that different. And that's what you find when you read The Future History of the Arctic by Charles Emerson, who is our guest, joins us by telephone from London. Charles, welcome to Talk of Alaska. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Good morning, I think.
Yeah, good morning and good evening in your case. Yes. So you are a geopolitical specialist for the World Economic Forum. I'm trying to picture what a person does in a job like that. And of course, reading your book, I can see that you did a lot of traveling. But do you have to actually like write white papers for Davos and things like that?
Well, that's something I used to do in the past. Certainly, we used to write reports for Davos, for the meeting, the World Economic Forum meeting, but also for various other meetings the forum does through the year. But there was a lot of thinking of grand thoughts.
Yeah, grand thoughts indeed. And now you're actually, you know, I guess ground truthing those ideas.
Well, it's one of the fascinating things about the work I did at the World Economic Forum. A lot of that was about geopolitical risk and how that intersects with environmental risk or how that intersects with energy security. But that was sort of almost in the abstract. But of course, in the Arctic, you can actually see on the ground how those subjects interrelate.
Well, they do. I mean, the Arctic is still remote. I guess we could say that. And
yeah.
It's very expensive to build anything up there. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline is considered one of the civil engineering wonders of the world, and it's all you have to do is get on a Russian icebreaker to realize that this is an expensive piece of shipbuilding.
it's a very expensive piece of shipbuilding, but of course the amazing thing about infrastructure anywhere, but particularly in the Arctic, is that of course once it's built and once it's running, once that sunk cost is there, once the investment is there, then all the other investments, for example, associated with oil and gas development, become a lot cheaper. So if you think about why, for example, the North Slope of Alaska has developed in terms of getting the oil resources in the North Slope of Alaska out of the ground, compared to the Canadian experience, the key reason, of course, is that in the 1970s the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was built and similar concepts of pipelines in the Canadian Arctic weren't built. And once that opportunity had been missed, if you like, in the Canadian Arctic, then development, of course, couldn't happen because the price of oil and gas wouldn't justify it. So the infrastructure is pretty key.
Yeah, Charles Emerson is our guest. He wrote The Future History of the Arctic, and he joins us from the United Kingdom. And Charles, you know, what you're saying really puts in sharp relief this ongoing fuss we have in Alaska about whether there's going to be a gas pipeline from the Mackenzie Delta down to Alberta, which they fear would put a potential enormously expensive gas pipeline from Alaska out of business or make it unfinanceable. But now, from what you're telling me, I'm seeing it a completely different way. Basically, all those resources up in Mackenzie and so forth, rich as they might be, and some apparently are essentially stranded because there's not a way to get them out of there.
Well, they're stranded now. I mean, the truth of the matter is that oil and gas resources don't get developed just because they're there. They get developed if it makes economic sense. And very often when there's a lot of infrastructure involved, if the political will is there, develop those resources. So consider the Russian experience, for example, where there's a lot of Arctic oil and gas resources, and those are tremendously important for the Kremlin, because they really are the basis for the financial strength of the regime within Russia, but also they are the basis of Russia's external leverage over its over the Europeans. But in the United States, really, whether those resources are developed or not depends an awful lot more on politics, and not necessarily Alaskan politics, but really politics in Washington.
Hmm. I am. We're right now. One of the controversial items here is about offshore oil drilling.
Yeah.
The situation, of course, is that there's just been this big spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And now that's raising questions about drilling in the Arctic. And meanwhile, Shell, you know, leaving BP out of the picture at the moment, Shell has got leases in the Arctic, which has invested an enormous amount of money in just acquiring the leases. And all of a sudden, it's just very nervous-making about whether they're going to get their permits and so forth to do the next stage of exploration that they say they need to do. So of course, there's keen interest in this this whole area from Alaska, because everybody's thinking about the jobs and so forth that bringing new fields on would require. But it's hard to see how, you know, in one case, Shell's leases are located to where they could conceivably be put into the Trans-Alaska pipeline if they were to develop oil. And in the other one, in the Chukchi Sea, there's no pipeline anywhere near that. The only possible way of developing that would be to either build a pipeline or to use some kind of offshore method, which is, you know, kind of what they've been doing in the North Sea.
Well, I mean, it should. I mean, Shell is not BP, and Shell is a very safety-conscious and company. It's, you know, it's a company of engineers. They've got a lot of experience in these kind of conditions, and it's worth pointing out that I think many of the places that they're proposing to drill are much, much, much shallower than what happened in the Gulf of Mexico. But equally, what the Gulf of Mexico showed really is that even in an area which is actually pretty well drilled, where companies also have a lot of experience, accidents do happen, and an accident on anything like the magnitude, in fact, far less the magnitude of what happened in the Gulf of Mexico, if that were to happen in the Arctic, then I think it's pretty clear the environmental consequences would be even more severe. So it's a big, big question, and I think it must be very, very difficult days for executives in Shell and ConocoPhillips and other oil companies who say, well, look, what happened in the Gulf of Mexico is dreadful, but it's an anomaly. It won't happen here. I think it'll be quite hard for their voices to be heard, and that may indeed mean that offshore drilling in certain parts of Alaska is put on hold and maybe postponed indefinitely.
Yeah. On the other hand, I think if you look at it globally, we're likely to see very much intensified research into how to respond to a spill and more accent on the blowout preventers and all that sort of thing that apparently there was a problem with in the Gulf of Mexico. In other words, it would seem that the whole industry is so interested in the Arctic at this point that there will probably be a lot of investment in showing that they can do it environmentally responsibly or whatever. Wouldn't you think?
Well, I'm sure that's true, that there'll be a redoubling of investment in certain types of prevention. But the truth is that if a spill did occur in broken ice, for example, then there is currently no real way of actually cleaning that up, no effective way of cleaning that up.
Well, you can burn it.
Than a spill in open sea.
Yeah, I mean, you can burn it. That's what they do off the coast of South Africa. And most of the places where there's a big spill, they would burn it. There's not a whole lot of experience with doing that in the ice. That's, as I understand it, globally, that's the problem.
Absolutely, it's the problem. And I think it's worth pointing out that the companies who have currently invested in Arctic areas, offshore Arctic areas of Alaska and elsewhere, are much more technologically capable than companies were 20 or 30 years ago. They're much more conscious of the environment. But still, mistakes can happen, accidents can happen. There's a likelihood that indeed they will happen.
Yeah.
And the consequences of that could be very serious indeed.
Well, yeah, we could easily just go on and on about the oil and gas thing, but there's so much else to talk about. There's fisheries, there's energy development, there's agriculture, meat production, so many things that really, many of which were really envisioned in the early years of polar exploration that now actually seem to be possibilities. And I think I'll choose shipping. The idea, do you think we are, within your lifetime, let's say, or let's even say within the next 10, 15 years, some shipping entity is going to go ahead and make the investment in a heavy enough icebreaking vessel to be able to just go ahead and go right across the Arctic Ocean, not even bothering to stick close to the coasts?
Well, I think it's possible. I mean, there was the first commercial shipment across the Northeast Passage, so across the north of Russia, in 2009. This summer, one of the big Russian, in fact, the big Russian state shipping company, Sovcomflot, has said that it plans to ship oil across that same route, so through Arctic Russia. I think it'll be some time before any company decides to invest in ships going really across the North Pole, because icebreakers are tremendously expensive, and you'd have to be shipping something extraordinarily valuable or extraordinarily time sensitive in order to actually make an investment by a private company worthwhile. But what I think you are likely to see quite a lot of in the short term, certainly in the next 10 to 15 years, is that if those oil and gas resources are developed, whether we're talking about the Alaskan Arctic or whether we're talking about the Russian Arctic and the Norwegian Arctic, where there's a lot of stuff already going on, you're going to see a lot more shipping around those developments, and that may be point-to-point shipping rather than shipping from one, across the North Pole from Europe to Asia, for example. I think that's further down the way. But who knows? That may well happen in my lifetime. We're actually moving in 2010 to having even less ice in the Arctic than we had 3 years ago. You may remember 3 years ago there was this tremendous interest in the Arctic suddenly because we reached a tremendous minimum of ice extent in the Arctic. Well, despite having a pretty hard winter where a lot of this ice froze back, actually in the summer of 2010, so this summer, this coming summer, we're actually on course to have less ice than has been in the Arctic, or less extent of ice in the Arctic, for many, many, many years.
Yep, I am. I'm watching those graphs from day to day myself.
they jump around a bit, right? But you can say that it's quite remarkable that in winter, so February, March, there was actually more ice than the mean over a 30-year period, but now actually there's far less ice. So if you like, the melt has been far, far more rapid over the last few months than is normal. That may be because the ice is thinner than in previous years, because there's a lot more new ice, which melts a lot more easily. All of that adds up to the possibility that ice extent will reach a new minimum in the summer.
Yes, I'm in touch with the remote sensing people who have worked out the estimates of multi-year and 1-2 year ice, and indeed, this is kind of within what they feared might be happening this year, where you actually saw heavy ice, and then by golly, the two lines just cross because it is not, there's not so much multi-year ice in there. And that's those projections, IPCC projections, pretty well already been blown out of the water, it looks like all the projections that they made after they saw 19 or 2008 wasn't quite as bad as 2007. Those projections are probably going to get another look now. and that changes a lot of other curves as well. So I'm talking with Charles Emerson. He's the author of The Future History of the Arctic, and it's a absolutely fascinating tour of every place around the Arctic Circle. And of course, I'm kind of concentrating on Alaska issues, but if you look at the map, you can see that Alaska is somewhat detached from the rest of the United States. And much of the territory of the Arctic is occupied by Russia and Canada, and some from Scandinavia. And there you have it, pretty much. Oh, yes, and there's Greenland. There's a fascinating study. We have the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, I guess, is meeting now in Greenland. And I guess there's thought that there's oil off the coast of Greenland.
Absolutely. Actually, one thing which happened just in the last few weeks, in fact, really went quite unnoticed, was the Greenlandic Parliament gave permission to a UK explorer to start looking for oil, to actively looking for oil, actually drilling for oil in offshore areas of Greenland. And of course, the reason the Greenlanders are so in favor of actually looking for these oil and gas resources is because Greenland has been ruled by Denmark, in effect, for several centuries. It's not economically self-sufficient. Greenlanders receive, in effect, about $10,000, $11,000 per head from Denmark. So if they could develop these oil and gas resources, then they might be able to achieve independence from Denmark. And that's a pretty large chunk of real estate, Greenland.
Yeah, it's interesting politically. Yes, it's an interesting political situation there, because of course the Alaska Inuit are part of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, so kind of keep an eye on the politics of Greenland. But the fact of the matter is that over the years, the Home Rule Parliament has gained quite a bit more sovereignty from Denmark. In other words, it's not this like hardcore colonial situation exactly.
No. I absolutely. And I mean, I think that most Greenlanders would admit that if you could have any colonial master, then you couldn't wish for a better colonial master than the Danes. But nonetheless, I think there is quite a strong desire for independence amongst Greenlanders. And resource wealth is where they see, it's where they see the money coming from that will make that possible. Interestingly, actually, when Alaska was purchased, of course, from the Russians in 1867, there was actually a report submitted to the Secretary of State to William Seward at the time, which recommended that he also go ahead and investigate purchasing Iceland and indeed Greenland. And indeed, Robert Peary was very keen on the idea that the United States should buy Greenland at the beginning of the 20th century, and indeed the subject even came up. I'm not really sure how advanced it ended up being, but the subject certainly came up at the end of the Second World War as well, when the strategic importance of Greenland, then particularly as an air base, had been realized, because there was a lot of ferrying of aircraft and troops across the north, stopping in Greenland on the way from the United States to Europe. So Greenland and the United States certainly have a very interesting history together as well.
Yeah, I think we still have a base there, as I recall. Maybe I'm wrong.
There is right up in the north. Yes.
Yeah, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And you know, the concept, the curves of development involving the Arctic are kind of often slower, but sometimes very sudden, but usually a bit slower than the process of development that swept across the continental United States, for instance. They're different. It's just so interesting that we're now seeing a lot of the visions of the explorers. That stuff is actually happening now. They might have thought, well, this is only 30, 40 years away, and it turned out it was more like 100, you know?
there's one interesting, very interesting character who I discuss in the book a bit, Vilhelm Stefansson, who is a Canadian explorer. He added a huge amount of territory to Arctic Canada at the very beginning of the 20th century, the very first few years of the 20th century, when Canada wasn't really entirely sure how far its Arctic possessions went in the north, and there were some questions over sovereignty. But Stefansson had this extraordinary vision of how the Arctic would be really a place of the future. He wrote this wonderful book called The Northward Course of Empire, and his idea was that, you know, whereas thousands of years ago the centers of civilization had all been in very hot places, if you like, very temperate places. In Cairo and Baghdad, then in Rome, and then later in slightly more temperate, slightly cooler places such as London and Paris, New York. Well, his vision was, we think that, you know, that line's just going to continue, and the center of civilization 20 or 30 years from now is going to be Winnipeg or Anchorage. And his justification really was that, we've got all kinds of technologies which were only just emerging at the beginning of the 20th century, the submarine, the airplane, and surely these new technological innovations will transform geography. And he thought it would happen all very suddenly indeed. Of course, it didn't quite happen that way, except in one place, which is interesting, in the Soviet Union, because it's easy to forget, first of all, that 60% of the Arctic is Russian, but secondly, that the Russian Arctic has far more people, far more infrastructure than any other part of the Arctic by a mile. So, for example, there are 300,000 people in the city of Murmansk in the Russian Arctic, which is more than there are in the entire Canadian Arctic. So if you're looking to see a developed part of the Arctic for good and, in many cases, for bad, then it's really in the Russian Arctic.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my heavens. Yeah, I've seen some of it. And, it was done Soviet style.
Oh, it certainly was. I mean, and of course, it could only happen, you know, that kind of development could only happen in a dictatorship that didn't recognize economic costs, didn't care about the environment very much, and, you know, used slave labor in a lot of places. I mean, it could only have happened in that political context. So in
right.
a way,
and lousy,
the fact that it didn't happen in Canada or the United States is simply a reflection of the democracy and good institutions of those countries.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, and that's, then we get to socio-political. Well, we're speaking with Charles Emerson, the author of The Future History of the Arctic, and just getting kind of a little glimpse of what sort of future there might be. In Alaska, they like to use the slogan, the last frontier. But, I think we don't take it seriously. We just sort of say it. But maybe it's actually happening. Maybe it really is. It really is a frontier. And we need to start paying attention to what that means to be on the frontier. And let's go all the way to the Arctic coast now. Our first caller is Eli, joins the program from Barrow. Hello, Eli.
Hello, good morning. My name is Eli, and I'm from Barrow, Alaska. I was listening to your radio show, and you guys were talking about ice pictures and also the ocean, and a lot of the ice cap melting. And, you know, the ice pictures they call, that they make nowadays, you know, they say they're environmentally friendly, and they're not really environmentally friendly. They are one of the reasons why the polar ice cap is melting nowadays. You know, you have one big ocean sheet of ice that is solid frozen, or it was, until the icebreakers start coming around. And when they started going up to the North Pole and going, you know, zigzag all around the Arctic Ocean, you know, when the wind started blowing, it moved that ice sheet and it broke off in many different places. And, you know, you got many different places with open water, and it has more than one area to be melting from.
Hmm.
Yes. Eli, thank you for that. You're up there. You're seeing it.
Yeah, we see it every year. And within the past 15 years, the ice has gotten a lot thinner and a lot farther out. And right now, if you go due west, you know, the ice is probably 100, 150, 200 miles from the ocean right now. And, you know, all these icebreakers from all the different countries, you know, it's just not only one icebreaker. It's many different other icebreakers cutting through the ocean and, you know, like breaking an eggshell.
Ray, that's a very interesting way. Yes, Eli, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm in contact with a number of these scientists who do this type of work, including the people on the icebreakers. And I'm going to take up this question and see what kind of answer I get, because it's the first time I've really ever heard it put so directly that it's kind of like the shell of an egg. And it would be interesting to see what they have to say and how they would go about trying to measure something like that.
It's very interesting. I mean, it's the first time I've heard it too. I mean, it stands to reason, though. Of course, the question would be whether the magnitude of the effect of the ice being broken in this way physically by the passage of icebreakers is really significant in terms of the actual melting of the ice. But I can imagine it would certainly have some effect.
Yeah. Are you, Charles Emerson, are you aware how the ice was different this spring in that it really hung around more in the Bering even than in than up in the Chukchi? It was a very unusual situation. The people up there really had never seen that before. We have one comment here from David Gordon, who is with Pacific Environment. He's got a point. The Gulf oil disaster responses required the mobilization of 36,000 people, over 6,000 vessels, over 2.5 million feet of boom. How would it be possible to stage this level of response somewhere in the Arctic, which lacks the infrastructure to do so? A response of this magnitude, God forbid, would likely cause even greater harm to the Arctic. The Arctic Council recently produced the Arctic Marine Shipping Assessment. It's clear that we could do far more to introduce environmental regulations over shipping to prevent oil spills, air pollution, and associated greenhouse gas emissions, and protect areas important for traditional use and harvest and environmentally and culturally important areas.
I think the point he makes is an absolutely excellent one. And the truth is that the resources could not be mobilized in the way they've been mobilized in the Gulf of Mexico, in the Arctic, really anywhere. But, of course, the point which energy companies would tend to make is, well, first of all, that the Gulf of Mexico's spill is an anomaly. It shouldn't be taken as because this has happened in the Gulf of Mexico, shouldn't rule out all offshore development everywhere. And, of course, they'd say, well, it happened in very, very deep water, whereas many of the offshore areas that are being considered for development in Alaska are actually relatively shallow. There may be lots of other problems, but depth of water, which has been a huge problem in the Gulf of Mexico in terms of the effort thereafter, after the spill, that's not so much one of the problems. But, of course, the truth is no oil company is never going to really be able to offer a 100% guarantee that there will not be any spill. And the consequences of any spill in the Arctic would clearly be greater than they would be almost anywhere else on the planet, including the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay, we're talking with Charles Emerson. He's the author of The Future History of the Arctic, and it's a fascinating history as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. If you've been through a lot of bad things and you feel like everyone would be better off without you, suicide isn't the answer. You're not alone. You have people who love you, and there is help. Call the Alaska Care Line at 1-877-266-HELP. Call, share, and live. If you're thinking about suicide, call for help at 1-877-266-HELP. This message sponsored by the Mindy Schloss Memorial Fund and the State of Alaska.
If the Arctic is going to be developed, the question is when. And when the Arctic is developed, in what order would that take place? And what would that development look like when and if the Arctic is developed? Charles Emerson is our guest, author of The Future History of the Arctic. Charles, the last time we discussed this subject was with Brian Fagan, also a British author, and he wrote a book called The Scramble for the Arctic. Have you had a look at that one?
I haven't seen that one, I'm afraid, no.
He sort of takes the big, even more of the big picture than you do, in the sense of going back to the Aboriginal occupations and, you know, how the migrations of the races and so forth happened. And then he moves it to the present day. And his point, essentially, and he was very... you know, he almost depressed when we talked to him. He said, look, the history of Western civilization encountering the Arctic is of complete ruthless exploitation. It's an absolute pattern. It has happened every single time, and I see no reason for it not to continue happening.
Well, let me give you one very, very good reason why it might not happen in the same way as the way it happened in the last several centuries or several thousand years. And one very, very good reason for thinking it might happen differently this time in some parts of the Arctic is democracy. And it's the fact that whereas 300 years ago we were essentially talking about something happening in the Arctic and public opinion really had no idea, public opinion such as it existed at that time really had no way of knowing what was happening in the Arctic, no way of knowing the kinds of encounters that were occurring in the Arctic. Now, first of all, there's a much, much greater political and environmental consciousness in general. Secondly, people in the more populated parts of the world, including the more populated part of the United States, which of course is tremendously important politically in determining what happens in the Arctic, people see what's happening in the Arctic. People have a much greater voice. While I think that the point of a general cultural meeting of the West and the North has tended to result in resource exploitation sooner or later, and very often that's had dreadful side effects, I think that there are in the fact of democracy, in the presence of pressure groups, in the environmental consciousness of the population, you have a few quite substantial bulwarks, which may mean that development either doesn't happen or happens in a way which is much, much, much more sustainable and in a much more environmentally friendly manner than would have been possible in the past.
That's very interesting. Charles Emerson is our guest. He's author of The Future History of the Arctic. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk@aprn.org. And Charles, that is very fascinating the way you put that, and it suddenly makes me realize that we're going to have to, if we try and look 50 years ahead into the future, we're going to have to factor in a much better GIS than what we currently have. In other words, the ordinary person in their armchair at their desk or, you know, doing risk management for an oil company or a shipper is going to have access right there on their computer screen to an incredible amount of information about what real-time information about the Arctic.
That's
this is really improved by light years just in the time I've been in Alaska, and it seems to be accelerating.
I think that's true, and I want to come back to a point you made right at the beginning when you said, would the Arctic be the new Mediterranean? And one of the interesting things about the Mediterranean, of course, what it means is center of the Earth, because at a certain point in history, the Mediterranean, the sea, was considered to be the center of civilization. And, you know, all the maps obviously would be centered on the Mediterranean because the world beyond wasn't particularly well known. Well, now we have a similar view of the world, or not a similar view of the world, but we similarly sort of discount the far north and the far south because our view of the world is totally shaped by the east-west direction. If you look at a map in any high school, a map of the world, there'll be the Americas in the middle, there'll be Asia on one side, and there'll be Europe on the other, and the Arctic and the Antarctic will sort of, you know, they'll look like the edges, they'll look like barriers beyond which one really can't travel. But if you spend much time in the Arctic, of course, then you'll see a completely different map of the world, which is a polar-centered map of the world, a map of the world centered on the North Pole. And I think that map may become a lot more understood and a lot more common in the next few decades. And that will also change people's perceptions about distance and about economics.
Well, it wasn't until a few years ago that I realized the main shipping route between Pacific, West Coast American ports and Northern Asian ports in China, Korea, Japan, passes right through the Aleutian Islands.
Absolutely.
You know, on a Mercator projection, that makes absolutely no sense, but all you have to do is do it on a globe and pull a string across there and you see where it goes.
Well, the maps are the most extraordinary things. I mean, Mercator came out with this one projection of the world, and there's a sort of certain tyranny associated with that because it's just shaped so many people's visions of, you know, what's close to what. A different vision of the world, a different map of the world, one centered on the North Pole, you get a very, very different idea of the strategic importance of the Arctic and of its economic and other potential.
Let's go to Bethel out in southwestern Alaska, where Michael joins the program. Michael, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah. Yes, good morning. My name is Michael Nick. I'm from Nunavichuk, and I'm originally Russian Orthodox, but in 2006, I converted to New Raven Church. I just want to read a little scripture from here after Noah's flood in Genesis 8:20-22. After the flood, that Noah built an altar to the Lord and took every clean beast and every clean fowl and offered burnt offerings on the altar. The Lord smelled sweet savor, and the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake, for in the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite anymore every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest time, cold and heat, summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. And in chapter 9, and God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And that's all I wanted to mention.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah,
from Genesis, right after...
from the beginning, Genesis, after the great flood.
Yes, indeed. Right on point, too. I love that. It's Talk of Alaska. The phone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@aprn.org. The great thing about your book, Charles, the Future History of the Arctic, is that you actually went to a bunch of these places.
Yes.
And so you can tell us firsthand what things are like there now. So you see, like, the world from the Arctic from the view of Iceland, the Arctic from the view of Norway, from Greenland, from Canada, from Alaska, and certainly from Russia. Did you go to Wrangel Island?
I didn't go to Wrangel Island. I would have absolutely loved to have gone to Wrangel Island. I'm afraid there's not that much there. Of course, I write about Stephenson's, Wilhelmina Stephenson's tragic idea that Wrangel Island should be developed as effectively as a colony of either Canada or the United States, and this adventure or misadventure turned out very, very badly, and then Wrangel Island was claimed by the Soviet Union, whereas previously there had been questions about exactly who owned it. But I spent a lot of time in really all of the Arctic countries, Greenland, Norway, quite a lot of time in Russia. The Russians have a very interesting and very different perspective in many ways on the Arctic. They view it very much as their backyard strategically, but also there's this idea of the Arctic being a source of great purity potentially. There's almost a sort of a religious association of the with the Arctic. In a way, I think there isn't so much, at least for most citizens of the United States. In Norway, of course, the Arctic is just what's all around, and the same I think too for Icelanders and Greenlanders. And in Canada, of course, the true north, strong and free, actually features in the national anthem. So popular cultural attitudes to the Arctic really differ in each of the Arctic countries.
In our celebration of 50 years of statehood that we kind of finished up last year, I had this really interesting invitation to speak to the Historical Society, where I tried to take a media point of view of the last 50 years and look ahead to the next 50 years. And it was just fascinating to me. The assignment basically was to... we're going to have some young people at this conference. What should be their take home? What should they be watching out for that we can learn about by looking at our last 50 years? What to watch for in the next 50 years? And I developed a set of predictions that they're all coming true already. and it happens. It's just basically by looking at the seeds of the future history of the Arctic are with us right now. I mean, it's just the question of which seeds are the ones that are really going to catch on and continue to develop. And so it's inevitable that we're going to have more agricultural production in the north, for instance.
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly possible. If I were the Food and Agricultural Organization deciding what we should do in order to improve agricultural productivity worldwide, then the Arctic is not the first place I would look. But nonetheless, there are factors changing, which mean, of course, that agriculture may become more profitable in the north, profitable in the north. There was an interesting study done by the Canadian Department of Agriculture a few years ago looking into what the consequences of climate change might be in northern parts of Canada. And their conclusions were that there would be an increase of 30, 40, 50, 60% in terms of the potential, agricultural potential of Canada. But very often these kind of studies actually miss other points. So the Canadian study was looking very much at temperature, and it was assuming, well, if temperature rises, then agricultural productivity will rise, et cetera, et cetera. So it was fairly simple. But then, of course, there are problems with water. What if there's not sufficient water for the crops? So it's very dangerous to draw straight lines based on, say, temperature exclusively in terms of determining what will or won't happen.
Oh, yes. And I think, just like the lines of longitude, they all come together in the Arctic. they're not very far apart, is my point. And so it's not long before you're running one string and all of a sudden you ran smack dab into another string. And I think that's what's so fascinating about the entire venture. But I think we could safely say, for instance, there will be more people probably living in the Arctic, in 50 years from now than there are now. We're seeing an interesting phenomenon in Alaska right now where people are paying a whole lot more attention to local food production just because it costs so much to ship it in. And you realize, well, there's one or another boom that, you know, shot all these people up to this place that was once a colony. It was always some, you know, whether it was oil discovered or gold discovered or copper, there was always something sending these waves of people up here. And then what happens then? there's all these people plus the people that were already here, and they all got to live together, and they all got to eat and so forth, you know. And there's a limit to what the land in its wild condition is going to provide. So and when they're, you know, policy eventually hovers around to these basic factors that are entering into it, that you have all these people, you have to feed them, and it's costing more and more for fuel.
Well, I think it's very interesting that in March this year there was a meeting of the coastal states of the Arctic held in Canada, and for the very, very first time, the United States Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, attended. Previously, there'd always been a senior official from the State Department when there'd been meetings of the same group where foreign ministers had gone. The United States Secretary of State had not gone, but to this meeting in Canada, the United States Secretary of State did go. And I think that's, in my mind, that's a sign that Arctic issues are beginning to rise up the agenda in Washington, and that's long overdue, but I think it is. I think that's certainly beginning to happen.
Our telephone number 1-800-478-8255 1-800-478-TALK as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
In 1989, with a group of journalists from Alaska, I made a trip into the Soviet, what was then the Soviet Far East of the Soviet Union. And we went, among other places, to this icebreaker port in the tin mining town of Pevek. And there was an icebreaker. And so they put us on it. And I'll tell you, Charles Emerson was one of the most impressive pieces of nautical engineering I'd ever seen. What a boat!
Well, it's amazing. I mean, the Soviet Union did some things very well. They built a lot. They liked things to be very big. They liked their icebreakers to be very big and very, very powerful. And they built the biggest, most powerful icebreakers that have ever been built. And they have many more of them than any other country. The United States has about, I think, sort of 2.5 icebreakers, really, because one of them is in port. The Russians now, of course, have many, many more than that. I don't know the precise number, but I mean it could be 12, 15, something of that order. But the icebreakers, and particularly the Soviet nuclear icebreakers, are pretty extraordinary beasts.
They are indeed. Let's go to Dennis, joins the program from Wasilla. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dennis.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to talk about transarctic shipping. I was in Holland about a year and a half ago, and they had a program on there about how they've improved the port of Rotterdam by improving the rail links for freight and the fiber optic cable links and the cranes for fast unloading of ships, trying to make their port a destination port for shipping over Russia and over Canada. And then also years ago, Canada extended their rail lines and their grain storage things at Churchill, their northern port, I guess anticipating this also. So other countries are doing quite a bit to anticipate the shipment, and I wanted to see what your guest has to say about the future of transarctic shipping.
Charles Emerson.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, Rotterdam is, of course, already an absolutely huge port. So, you know, it's constantly growing and constantly adding more cranes, etc. And it may end up being, of course, a place where Arctic shipping does go. In terms of Churchill in Canada, of course, the interesting thing about, well, there are several interesting things about Churchill, but the one of the interesting things about it is that the railway line to Churchill is actually quite unstable. It's reported to be quite unstable, and as the permafrost melts, it may become less stable. So even if ships find it more easy to get to Churchill, the goods which are in Churchill, it may be very, very hard to get them actually from Churchill to Canadian markets or to American markets. So I think there's a lot of people who are beginning to think about the possibility of transarctic shipping. There was a report produced by the Icelandic government a few years ago that suggested that maybe Iceland should host a transshipment port, which would be like Rotterdam, but in Iceland, and it would deal really specifically with transarctic shipping. But we haven't seen very much Arctic shipping yet, really.
Dennis?
Well, I also heard that the Canadian government had made agreements to link the rail line from Churchill all the way down to Monterrey, Mexico.
Phew!
And so the it would make sense that Chinese ships that would go over the Arctic to unload either in Europe or the east coast of the U.S. on their way back could pick up shipments of grain or things from Canada. So anyway, it just seemed like quite an economic thinking of the future, you know, the future economics.
I think it's possible, but it's one of those things where until it actually all comes together, it's going to remain a sort of a grand vision until it actually happens. And I think we're some way from it actually happening yet. I think we have a lot of visions, we have a lot of ideas, but I'm not sure the numbers stack up yet. I think there are going to be lots of failed attempts actually before we get to a sustainable business model for Arctic shipping. But the interesting thing is we are beginning to see those first probing investments.
Well, thank you.
All right, Dennis, thanks a lot. Fascinating call. And, you know, people, basically, it's not just the private sector, or in other words, the investment community that is looking at this. You also have to factor in the governments. So it does get really kind of cumbersome with all these different interests because, you know, if a country decides, like the Dutch, oh, it's time for the rebirth of the Hanseatic League, and, you know, so we'll build up our port because that way we can be the major port for Arctic shipping, and Iceland may be thinking the same way. It just gets very, very interesting.
It does get very interesting, and I mean, it's always been that way in the Arctic, or at least for the last 100 years, is that economic development, even if the major investors are actually from the private sector, the state has to be involved somewhere along the line in terms of offering guarantees or offering political cover or offering soft loans or maybe all of those things in order to kickstart the development process. That is, in effect, what happened, really, with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline as well, and I think with a lot of big infrastructure investments in a region as harsh as the Arctic, unless the government stands behind it in some way, those developments are unlikely to happen.
We had the oceanographer on who went out and mapped on a couple voyages back of the Healing, went out and mapped the subsea. And he was talking about the law of the sea and how you make territorial claims and all that sort of thing. What do you make of this territorial, what will probably be kind of an imbroglio between Canada and the United States in particular? Because they just simply dispute a border that if you extrapolate it off into the longitudes there, gets to be a huge amount of ocean.
Yeah, absolutely, and but potentially a very rich area of ocean as well. I mean, if there is going to be offshore oil and gas development, and maybe there won't be, but if there is going to be offshore oil and gas development, or some other kind of mineral development, frankly, 30 years from now, 40 years from now, who knows, that piece of real estate may be worth quite a lot. Now, I don't think the United States and Canada are going to go to war over this, or those two countries are, of course, extraordinarily close allies on so many issues, and are, of course, neighbors permanently. But there is certainly room for tension there. I think, interestingly, we've only got 3 or 4 years left. The clock is really ticking here on Canada and Denmark making their final claims under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea for ownership of the sea and the seabed in the Arctic, adjacent to their territory. So these issues are really coming to a head in the next couple of years. Of course, the United States isn't yet a signatory to UNCLOS, but the State Department will tell you that they don't believe that affects in any way their rights in terms of sovereignty and ownership.
Not only will they, but they have.
Yes.
All right. Well, yes, this is absolutely fascinating. And of course, now we're off to the international law part of the discussion, though. I was kind of hoping that we would stay off of, because it's a briar patch.
Well, it is a briar patch. But one of the interesting things about it, I mean, apart from the complications of the law itself, I don't know who it was you spoke to from one of the U.S. mapping missions. But I remember distinctly listening to
Larry Mayer.
One of these. Sorry?
Larry Mayer.
Oh, Larry Mayer. Okay, fine. Well, I saw Larry Mayer speak, I guess it was, 2 years ago now, in Oslo, and he showed us this sort of rather wonderful an image of the subsurface of an image of the ocean floor, if you like, sort of computer generated. And he showed one where this is what we expected to find, and it was basically all flat. And then he showed a second one where he said, well, this is what we actually found. And there was this huge mountain,
right.
this mountain, you know, underneath the water, which no one had known about before.
Yeah.
And the truth is that although on a map, on a bathymetric map of the Arctic, you'll see sort of nice lines which join up, and you know the deeper water will be a darker blue, and the lighter the less deep water will be a lighter blue, and it all looks perfect. The truth is, that's actually not what's really out there.
Charles Emerson, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Yes, the book is The Future History of the Arctic, and he joined us from London, where it's evening. Paige Corona and Josh Edge on the phones, Dave Waldron on the controls, and next week, it's Craig Medrid, and we'll talk about the idea about it. Yeah, we'll go to the dogs. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. Crane accidents are on the rise around the nation. Making sure that crane operators are properly trained and certified is crucial to minimizing accidents in Alaska. Equally important is ensuring that riggers and signal persons are adequately trained. More information is available at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.